You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
So it felt like all of the different topics we're going to be exploring on Internet Hate Machine kind of all intersected last week with the finalization of Elon Musk taking over Twitter, the attack on Nancy Pelosi's husband Paul by a man armed with a hammer, and of course, Elon Musk using his newly purchased social media platform to spread baseless conspiracy theories about the attack. Now, according to Paul Pelosi's alleged attacker's own writings online, it was Gamergate that he credited with providing a gateway into extremism and conspiracy theories. And, you know, I started this podcast to explore the ways that the internet can have a big impact on our social and political landscape. And honestly, sometimes I kind of hate being right about it, because online movements like Gamergate are still harming our political landscape today. And Dr. Joan Donovan, research director at the Harvard Kennedy Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy, and co-author of the book Meme Wars, is not surprised. Dr. Donovan, thank you so much for being here. So were you surprised to find out that Paul Pelosi's attacker credited Gamergate as being a political turning point for him?
Unfortunately, in this world that I work in, I very rarely am surprised. So why this is important, of course, is that there are moments in our internet history that many people consider landmark moments for on the right, they call it getting red pilled, right? And so the red pill is a reference to the Matrix. You can either take the blue pill and live your life as if nothing is going on, or take the red pill and you can see the world for what it is. And there were many things going on during Gamergate, particularly violent misogyny, anti-Black racism, homophobia, transphobia. So within Gamergate, there were many ways in which someone could have become red-pilled or awoken to this world where they think they're finally seeing reality for the first time. And this is intensely problematic, generally because the way in which this starts usually is by digging into more and more media online. So you move away from mainstream media. You think the mainstream media is there simply to lie to you. And you start to go into these different rabbit holes trying to understand, well, then how do I make sense of this world? Conspiracies tend to fill that void. The difference with Gamergate, though, is that this was a real set of events that were happening and unfolding in this moment where it wasn't just that we were seeing misogynistic, racist, homophobic, transphobic, inciting content moving around online, it was also starting to show up in people's real lives. And we saw the violence of swatting and the harassment and even intimidating people at their workplaces and their homes or at conferences. And so it was a very different time as well. And this maybe will be the last point I'll say on this, is that during Gamergate, people learned these trolls and these misogynists, these racists, all these ilks of people learned how to coordinate with one another. So it goes back even before Gamergate in different campaigns that most famously probably is Your Slip is Showing, which I know that you've covered as well, where Black feminists were able to figure out very early on that they were being impersonated on Twitter and were able to show what those accounts meant and what they were up to and how easy it is to manipulate the system or the design of social media in order to produce this targeted harassment. And so I wouldn't be surprised, although I don't have any evidence of it yet, that moments like that as well, that are highly participatory, that have these instantaneous feelings of reward and camaraderie for getting someone to shape, you know, shut down their account, getting them to block you, whatnot, is definitely something that we see unfortunately, many of the folks that end up being part of these movements over the long term participate in early on.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up. On this series, we're starting with Adria Richards, you know, Donglegate. And, you know, this thing that I think a lot of people, even people who were pretty online, might have seen as like a blip, but to me really marks something interesting, an interesting shift around exactly what you were talking about, this, the reward of feeling like, oh, we got this person to, you know, shut up online or to lose their job or to, you know, shut down their accounts or block people, like that having a sort of instantaneous reward for folks and that being like a participatory thing that people would want to take part in.
Yeah, and that's, I think that actually speaks to the changing nature of political participation. You know, when we first started to think about the internet as a political space, blogs. Everybody had a blog. They had a political opinion. Then you start to see slowly, beginning with the so-called Arab Spring, people are using the internet to get coordinated, and they're doing it to get coordinated in public space. And I think what the far right does really, what the far right really adds to this set of tactics is they have these hybrid sets of tactics where they do a lot of online organizing, and the point is to upset or defame someone online. And it's for them almost just as effective as, you know, showing up at the mayor's house and protesting in front of his house until he resigns, right? For them, the wins are a lot, the goals and the wins tend to be a lot smaller, but they also tend to be quite a bit more personally painful for people who become targets of this kind of harassment. And when it comes to what we've seen in the social media of the man who attacked Mr. Pelosi is that he had really followed along with a lot of the more mainstream internet conspiracy theories. It's not the case that he's in things that are, it's, well, you know this, there's like the internet and there's the internet where there's things that are popular that nobody's ever heard of, but he seems to be in that popular vein of conspiracy and he's following along, which denotes to me that he was part of a community, that he was, you know, listening to other people and following along, thinking he was doing his own research. But ultimately, he was being fed all of these lies. And the way that these things start to plug together around election denialism and the subversion of the U.S. democratic process, if you truly do believe that all else has been tried and failed, the only recourse people feel that they have is violence. And reading some of the pronouncements of this man where he says, you know, he wanted to break Nancy Pelosi's kneecaps so that she would be a reminder to politicians that you can't just lie. And that it's that kind of delusional belief in one's own power that makes people move from the wires to the weeds in this, what is perceived as very lone wolf kind of way. But that's not to say that this person hadn't been supported in part of communities online before he ended up taking these last steps.
I would imagine that for a lot of people, the idea that this movement online of guys who were big mad about ethics and gaming journalism, in scare quotes, would then be related to this like political attack on Nancy Pelosi's husband. Do you think we're going to start seeing more people making that connection of those two, things being related?
Well, what's interesting, I think, is a few things, which is that we are getting a lot of different vantage points from which to tell the history of Gamergate. You can tell the story through the tactics of resistance. In our book, or you could tell the story from the vantage point of how mass media covered it. In our book, we really wanted to understand the relationship between Steve Bannon and Milo Yiannopoulos and the way in which Milo originally had come out and thought Gamergate was dumb, and he misread the audience. He missed it. And so he had to do a mea culpa and come back and say, yes, this is about ethics and gaming journalism. And because he had the platform of Breitbart, it gave that movement the belief in their own legitimacy, because that's what media really does, is it makes people feel legitimate and recognized and seen. That's why all movements strive to have media coverage. And so in memoirs, as we were trying to tell that story, it was really important that we looked at and tried to show how some of those tactics that Milo was part of organizing, that were being organized on 4chan, then get filtered through someone like Steve Bannon, who is the bridge between these online populist movements and the president of the United States and the Republican Party. And you see this dramatic shift in how Trump uses his own social media, how, you know, White House media and media properties is used once these folks who are learning from that very online contingent of people are learning how to take those tactics and move them into mainstream politics. I mean, there's really nothing fundamentally that different from what was happening during Gamergate to when Trump is pointing at CNN and calling it fake news, right? It's almost the same narrative. It's really about ethics in mainstream journalism, right? And I think once we start to think through, well, what are people asking for from media? Does mainstream media have a responsibility to tell the truth? If it does, then what is this partisan media that we're paying a lot of attention to? Do we allow news organizations that are partisan to call themselves news? It becomes a much more complicated question once we realize that the tactics that seemed jokey and small and part of low culture then become mainstream political tactics. And there's a lot to be said, though, for studying the resistance to that and figuring out, well, how did people get through Gamergate? How did feminists come out the other side? Which I know some of your own research and podcasting has done. But there is a disconnect here between that style of resistance that tends to happen within communities. There's no real connection between that and any political party type of way, right? You don't see the same kind of sutures like you do on the right between the internet world and the party. So there is some work to think about related to the Gamergate tactics becoming mainstream political tactics, there's a lot of work to think through. Well, what does the resistance to that look like? And are there politicians that are willing to take up the charge and make sure that those resistance tactics get the same kind of value and attention as all of the baddies? You know, it's all the bad guys online.
That's such an interesting point that I didn't even really think about because, you know, Bannon clearly had a lot of takeaways about how those tactics could be used to build political power on the right. And we don't similarly have a kind of infrastructure that then asks, well, how did feminists and Black women online, you know, resist this? How did they lean into the power of community to strengthen their own online spaces, even when people with institutional power really didn't help them? And so we don't really have that same level of interest, I guess, in how we then support that same kind of resistance that there is on the right.
Yeah, and it's a tricky thing. I've talked in the past with Ruha Benjamin about this and about tactical disclosures, because what you don't want happening is much mainstream attention to the tactics that are working when they're working. Because usually when we're talking about community safety, we're talking about instances where community members have figured out an inside line to get things done, either to get corporations to change their minds about something. I'm thinking here about the organizing of Color of Change around blood money and getting PayPal and other payment services to stop paying white supremacists. Those tactics, they feel very ephemeral because I think, you know, they've been historicized by academics, but they haven't been taken up as serious policy by politicians. So when I would say that when we talk about institutional support, you know, academics can take it far, but really what we need is that layer or that muscle between those resistance tactics translated into policy so that we can change the design and not just try to change, you know, one by one, the bad actors.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
My name is Johnny B. Goode, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
In the work that you and I do, so much of the work that we're doing is like focused on individual bad actors or individual, and it just feels like playing whack-a-mole. And it is, you know, it's what we're doing, but it never feels like enough. It feels like even if we were doing this work at the capacity that we, you know, like working at it 24/7, it wouldn't be enough. We need infrastructure change. We need deeper, more meaningful changes because, you know, banning, deplatforming a bad actor here and there is great, but it's not going to have that like lasting change.
Yeah. And that's where we end up at the end of our book, really, is this idea that the design has to be much more intentional. You know, if you think about Musk buying Twitter is the most influential news distribution system in the world. Now, it was never designed purposefully to transmit the news, right? And so Musk, who's now anti-media, is in charge of it. And, you know, you have to wonder where he's going to go with that. But it's certainly not going to be into, you know, adding to the integrity of information online, right? And so, you know, I do think that there are great academics out there that do that work of working with movement. I'm thinking here of my dear friend at UC Irvine, Roger Crooks, who work with movements and try to do research based upon the questions that they have. I do think it's really important, especially today, to keep our eyes on the innovation and the kind of entrepreneurship of the far right, because of how important they are for culture in terms of shaping the culture, especially around certain issues that we cannot fail on. We cannot fail on fighting anti-Black racism, transphobia, especially these days. You know, we have to fight for public health because the state's not going to do it. And so, you know, I often think about it as this paradoxical process where I'm always trying to understand the broader system, the implications for it, but I'm never going to make the mistake of thinking that pro-social movements use the same technology the same way that anti-democratic ones do or white supremacists do. It might fundamentally be the same technology, but they bring to it different sets of values, different skill sets even, and make that platform or that media do something that other groups aren't able to or haven't really thought of yet. And that's why I think it's up to us to try to build more of a whole of society approach. We want to be working with technologists. We want to be working with librarians and educators. We want to be working with activists, because we need to reshape the information ecosystem. And, you know, it's a pretty dark day for a lot of people who formed really lasting and important friendships and social solidarities on Twitter, because if you can't trust the platform, it's going to be harder and harder to trust each other. And so it's going to be really important going forward that people find alternative spaces to have these broader, bigger picture conversations, especially people that live in diasporas that need to build global solidarities. But it's, as I've been thinking about it, you know, it's a, in some ways, Musk is undoing the last decade of hard work of a lot of people, not just the people who work at Twitter, but a lot of people who have made these networks and friendships and organizations along the way, which is not to say that we have to throw that all away instantaneously, but I do think it gives us more of a mission-driven focus on getting the infrastructure in place and thinking about, well, how could that infrastructure then be weaponized against us like it was during events like Gamergate?
Yeah, I've heard you speak and write really eloquently about the deep need to build a public interest internet, an internet that is really meant to serve the people. But I also happen to know that you're a little bit of like a pessimist, that you aren't necessarily super, well, you tell me, how do you feel about that?
I mean, you know, I'm not one to suggest that this is the whole of it, which is that if we get the technology right, all of the sudden, you know, what ails us in our society is somehow going to be fixed. But I do know what it's like to live without the internet. I am old enough to remember things were different, and the scale was smaller and the achievements were smaller. And so there's been a lot of forward social progress, and a lot of accountability that has been, you know, spread around as a result of social media. And we've seen new voices rise and fall. And that, I think that's what I love about the internet, is the ability to meet and coordinate with people that are not like me, or people that are like me, but are so far away from where I am that I never would have had the opportunity to meet them otherwise. And, you know, you're talking to a punker that like booked their first tour on AOL, you know, like AOL hardcore music chat room, right? Like that's where I come from. And so, yeah, I think that there are things that are exciting, different possibilities that are exciting. And each, you know, group finds its platform, and those platforms evolve. And maybe it is the case that, you know, when I was finding my identity and my people, my platform was the record player, right? In the sense that like punk was still holding on to this, you know, analog technology. But it created this whole culture of trading and listening and making tapes for other people. It doesn't feel the same with Spotify. It almost feels like you're cheating when you're like, oh yeah, I'll put you together a little mixtape here and ship it, right? It just doesn't have the same time commitment, I think. But that's not to say that that's my experience, but that's not to say that that's the same experience of a young person who's like making videos and expressing themselves. And those are the things that I think we're going to lose if we don't step up to protect the health of the internet now. And if we don't ask for layers of public infrastructure to ensure that one man with, you know, billions of dollars can't take away something that has value for tens of millions or hundreds of millions. As well, I think conversely, thinking about information in the public interest, the history of our journalism had to go through a process like this, you know, where journalists really had to think about how do we professionalize, how do we create information that is objective. We don't always like that style of journalism, especially if it gets too both sidesy, especially if one side is lying. But there's a method there and a commitment to ethics, and we don't have any of that at the backbone of our internet when it comes to these few companies that have really committed a smash and grab on our economy and taken with it much of the funding for our truth-telling institutions. So, you know, I'm a little bit optimistic about what we should build and how do we do it and how do we make sure that it's serving the widest possible group. And I think that we do need to deal with some of our antitrust laws to get there and break up some of these companies that have bought everything. But pessimistically, yeah, like I, you know, the people that hate us aren't going away. They're not going away. They're not going to go away just because we build the most perfect technology. They're not going to go away if we build, you know, gates around our properties either. It's just, you know, at some point we have to reckon with each other. And my commitment to life is always about dignity. You know, how do we make sure people live with dignity and that they live lives with, you know, certain civil rights? And I do believe that the right to communication should be free. Mm-hmm. And I do think that the right to communication is critical. But I don't think that means you should be able to, you know, politically oppress people, or that you should have access to broadcasting to 80 million people lies and disinformation or hate harassment and incitement. But I think I hold paradoxical opinions that maybe aren't completely reconcilable.
Yeah. I mean, I just have to, this is a non sequitur, but I have to tell you, when you were talking about the vibe of, you know, records and making mixtapes, mm-hmm. I was in a relationship with someone that I did not know was a big jam band fan. And then when we moved in together, I found all these boxes under the bed and I was like, what's in these boxes? And he was like, oh yeah, for 10 years, I would go to parking lots where Grateful Dead concerts were happening, and I would trade and buy and sell bootlegs. And that's this is a box of those bootlegs. And I was like, what the hell? we are losing
it's
that.
True. I know. Yeah. And it's happening in different ways. I mean, yeah, I was just in Poland and I went to a party where many of the people were in the crowd enjoying the music and the DJs, but they were making TikTok videos in the crowd. And I was just like, why are all these people videotaping themselves, right, while there's a performer happening, right? And but it's like, you know, maybe that's just how they feel expression, right, and community. But I also don't want us to lose the capacity to realize that all of our humanities are connected, you know, in a very cheesy kind of like, well, at the end of the day, we all got to live together. But, you know, I think that there are lines that need to be drawn, of course, with that kind of rhetoric. But yeah, like, I think the role I would love for the internet to play in people's lives is one of creativity, one of bringing people together, one of, you know, not so much just entertainment, but of building and collaborating together.
That's a beautiful vision. Dr. Donovan, thank you so much for being here.
Internet Hate Machine is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, check out our website, coolzonemedia.com, or find us on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases, and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta
right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
It's brand new season 2.
I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf-Fedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.